Verses 7 through 17, 7 through 13 of chapter 17, Judges. And there was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man part out the city from Bethlehem, Judah. He sojourned where he could find a place, and he came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. And Micah said unto him, Whence comest thou? And he said unto him, I am a Levite of Bethlehem, Judah, and I go to sojourn where I may find a place. And Micah said unto him, Dwell with me, and be unto me a father and a priest, and I will give thee 10 shekels of silver by the year, a suit of apparel, and thy victuals. So the Levite went in. And the Levite was come to dwell with the man, and the young man was in him as one of his sons. And Micah compensated the Levite, and the young man became his priest, and was in the house of Micah. Then said Micah, Now know I that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite, my priest.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm always thankful for the opportunities that I have. Thankful for Carl for those songs, Greg for that prayer, Shane for the reading. It's always good to have brethren that are willing to step up and serve the Lord in whatever ways and opportunities come before them. In Judges chapter 17, we come across an interesting situation, and we kind of jump in the middle of the story. But at the beginning of Judges chapter 17, if you'll turn over there, we find an individual named Micah. And Micah gets some of this silver, and he decides, along with his mother, he's going to make an idol. And he takes this idol, and he puts this idol in his house. So Micah now has this idol in his house, and he really goes a step beyond that. He takes his son, and he makes his son a priest. And when I start to look at that situation, what would you call that? I'd say a guy making his own religion. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. He makes, in the beginning of 17, we see he gets his hands on the silver. He sets it in verse 5. It says the man, Micah, has his shrine, and we start to see these things that he starts to do. It's like he's making his own religion. He's got an idol. He's got a priest. And then we have this individual, this young Levite, that comes to visit him. This young Levite, although the Bible doesn't really express his religious background, from a historical perspective, we know kind of what someone from the tribe of Levi might be doing. A person from the tribe of Levi could be a Levi priest. Now, it does not say that this young Levi is a Levi priest by any means, but what I am saying is from his family background, he probably understands some Jewish traditions, some of the things that Jews and the people following God would be doing. Well, this Levi shows up to Micah's house, and he's traveling, and Micah opens his house to him, and then he makes him an offer. He says, hey, you're a Levite, right? How about you be my priest? And we see the offer that is made to this young Levite. 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and basically, just his basic living, his sustenance, those type of things. You know, I look at the situation, and it got me thinking. We actually were going through Judges in the teen class, and it got me thinking. You look at this individual, and it's almost like if you saw a Levite go into a guy's house that was openly practicing idolatry, I don't know if the response that you would expect would be for him to say, yeah, I'll join you. Why not? I think you might expect a reaction of, why do you have idols in your house? Why have you called your son a priest? Don't you know that the priests are supposed to come from the tribe of Levi? I mean, that's maybe the reaction you're expecting, but that's not the reaction we see. We see that this individual, this young Levi, his religion's for sale. His religion's for sale. His beliefs are for sale. And even though the Bible doesn't give us a background necessarily on this individual in particular, and we do understand throughout the book of Judges, Israel is having this constant yo-yo back and forth with God where they're bad, and then they'll pray to God and repent, and then they'll be good for a while, and then they go back to being bad, and then it gets so bad they say, God, why don't you help us again? So Judges, Israel is falling apart in many respects, away from God and repenting, going back to God. So I'm not saying that he necessarily came from the best household, but it seems like this individual's beliefs are for sale.
In fact, as the story goes on, 600 Danites come to the house, and they had weapons, and they pull the idol out of the house, and they make another deal with this Levite. They say, hey, you know what? You're a priest right now for this house of, you know, just a few people. Why don't you come with us and you can be a priest for 600 people?
You know, it seems like this man's religion is for sale.
Seems like he just goes to the highest bidder. The first highest bidder is the person that first offers, you know, the yearly wage and the clothing and those types of things. It seems like his religion's for sale. And then in chapter 18, when these Danites come to the door with their weapons and they confiscate the idols, they say, hey, you want to come with us? They said, sure. It's my best option, I guess. Is your religion for sale?
I think as we look around the religious world, this is something that's becoming more popular.
If people are selling out their religion, it's when it's convenient, when it's expedient, what they do is they take the opportune time and they say, you know what, my beliefs really aren't that important. I'll take another road as long as I am compensated in some way, and people are compensated in many ways throughout this life.
You know, we see Micah, I think he's given, not Micah, but this young Levi. This young Levi has gotten this negotiation with Micah where I think he has exchanged money for his religious belief.
And I think we look at that, and we look at that and say, you know what, that's wrong. How could he ever get in a situation where he would do something like that, sell his religion, sell his belief,
instead of being convicted to those things that probably he should be convicted to? You know, people exchange their masters throughout this life. People in the religious world, I think slowly but surely, there's a big sign out there that says, is your religion for sale? Because if your religion's for sale, there's a lot of buyers out there.
We'll take your religion, we'll buy it, and we'll give you this in exchange. And the world and Satan has certainly made very attractive options that people are going to in droves and saying, you know what, my religion is for sale. My beliefs are for sale. You know, you give me 10 shekels of silver a year, you give me some clothing, you give me some food, you know what, my religion's for sale. I'll follow whatever you say, I'll believe whatever you say, I'll do whatever you want me to do.
It's interesting in religion how we can look so easily at a case and say, what is this guy doing?
And how we can look out in the religious world and say, what are these people doing? But the real trick is, can we look at ourselves? Can we challenge ourselves and look at ourselves, evaluate ourselves and say, you know what, am I selling out my own religion? Am I selling out my own beliefs? Because I think we find Bible characters throughout the New Testament, throughout the Bible, that they had occasions in their life where they had to ask their question, am I going to sell out my religion? Am I going to stick to what I believe, or am I going to give in to the pressures that are around me and give up my beliefs? It seems like the predominant belief in religious fields today is, what can the church give me? What can religion give me, instead of maybe perhaps they're forgetting that we have to give ourselves? You know, I think of that passage in Matthew chapter 16, verses 24 and following. It says, then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Seems like that's the exact opposite of what people are looking for. People are exchanging their masters, and it looks like religion can be bought by the world. And people are going it each and every day. Let's look at some individuals that I think fell into a trap where, at least we could say that they have put themselves in a situation where it appears that their religion could be for sale. Number one, Matthew chapter 26. You know, we all have weak times. We all have times of struggle and temptation. And I think Peter, in Matthew chapter 26, is in one of those hard situations of his life where he's going to ask himself, you know, is my religion for sale? And it might not come in the form that you're always expecting. It might not come in the form that we see in Judges chapter 17. See, in Judges chapter 17, we see a very clear transfer. Hey, I'll give you this money and come into my religion. But it's not always that clear. We have Peter fall into another situation in Matthew chapter 26 that I fear that sometimes people fall into the same type of trap. Matthew chapter 26, we have verses 69 through 75, we have Peter's denial. It says, now Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him, saying, you also were with Jesus of Galilee. But he denied it before them, all saying, I do not know what you're saying. And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, this fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth. But again he denied with an oath and said, I do not know the man. And a little later, those stood by came up and said to Peter, surely you also are one of them, for you speak, your speech betrays you. And he began to curse and swear, saying, I do not know the man. Immediately a rooster crowed, and Peter remembered the word of Jesus, who had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So that he went out and wept. I think Peter had a momentary laugh, but you think, Peter's problem wasn't with money, was it? Yeah, and people can argue exactly what's going through Peter's mind. Maybe he's thinking about physical persecution, but Peter sold his religion to people. He sold his religion to peer pressure, and I understand that Peter made a mistake, and I understand that we all make mistakes, and I know that we all sin, fall short of the glory of God, but in this moment, didn't Peter just distance himself from his religion? Distance himself from Jesus Christ. Perhaps he couldn't use the word religion. He distanced himself from Jesus. I don't know Jesus. And he says what it says in Luke chapter 12 and verse 9. It says, but he who denies me before men will be not denied before the angels of God. Certainly Peter has made a mistake here. And Peter, I think this is not the only time Peter struggles with this. I think in Galatians chapter 2 we see something similar. It seems like Peter has a trouble with peer pressure. Now you say, you look at Peter, and I think we have this problem where we either put a person way up on a pedestal or we try to tear him way down. And, you know, I think the most fair way to look at it is we're all people. And we have good days and we have bad days and we all make mistakes and we all sin, fall short of the glory of God. So it might seem that I'm being very hard on Peter, but did Peter make a mistake? Yes, he did. He made a mistake. The question is when you're surrounded by people, do you sell your religion? Do you deny your religion? Do you say, just for a moment, just for a period of time, I'm going to walk away? I wonder if sometimes people, they'll look at all these situations that they can't see them themselves. I think Peter had a problem with this. When certain people came around Peter, was he willing to give up Christ or aspects of his Christianity? I think on occasion he did do that. I think we can see it in his denial. And I think we also see in Galatians chapter 2, if you turn it over there. In Galatians chapter 2, Peter's confronted. What's he confronted about? In Galatians chapter 2, verses 11 through 13, it says, now when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed. For before certain men came from James, he would eat with the Gentiles, but when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision. And the rest of the Jews also played the hypocrite with him, so that even Barnabas was carried away with their hypocrisy. What was Peter doing? He wouldn't eat with the Gentiles if Jews were coming to town. Seems like a small thing. I think we look at it and say, yeah, Peter made a mistake there. In fact, we see the confrontation, it brought up in Galatians chapter 2, when Peter was in certain situations in the denial, and when we see, and even in the New Testament, seems like Peter sometimes falls to this thing called peer pressure. And I wonder if we do the same thing. Because it's easy to look at Peter, it's easy to look at this young Levite and say, I would never sell my religion. I'd never compromise my religion in any situation. But yet, what do we see Peter? We see Peter deny Christ. We also see Peter do something that we would say is not Christian. You know, saying, I'm not going to meet with these brethren basically because of their race. I'm not going to eat with them because of their race, because of these people, so on and so forth. Do we do this in our lives? When different people walk into the room, does your religion change? When different people walk into the room, does your religion change? Because that's kind of what it's looking like. You know, when these people walk in, Peter feels pressure and he changes. When these people walk into the room, Peter changes. When people walk into the room, do you change your religion because of them? Do you change your relationship with Christ because of them? Are you selling out your religion? You know, that's a really difficult life to live, isn't it? It's much easier in certain aspects to stay convicted to your beliefs. I am going to believe what I believe. I'm going to stand with Jesus Christ 100% of the time. We understand the challenge that that is. We see it in the Apostle Peter. We see the struggles that he has with it. So, you know, it's hard to have two masters, but that's somehow, sometimes how people live their lives. In Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24, it says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and man." But that's what people try to do sometimes when people come around. When I go to work, I'm this person. When I go to church, I'm this person. When I go to school, I'm this person. Did your religion change by the people that are in the room? Do your beliefs change based off the people that are in the room? Is your religion for sale? I don't know. You know, it's hard to live a life like that. Your master's changing all the time. You know, I go to school, my master is this. When I go to work, my master is this. When I go to church, my master is this. You can't live like that. It's going to tear you apart. You can't do that. And certainly God is going to see straight through that. But people try to live their lives that way. And they say, you know what? Maybe I'll do what this young Levite did in Judges. And just for a year, I'll sell myself. You know, I'll be your priest for a year. And then after that year's over, I'll try to repent and try to get back to what I should be doing. But some people do it so quick. They switch out of these different masters so quickly. When people go off into different settings, do they change? Do they change their Christian beliefs? Do they change their Christian values? Do they change what they stand for? Or do they stick to their beliefs and their allegiance to Jesus Christ? You think of work. Are you a different person at work? Or maybe around your family. Maybe it's that family barbecue. Maybe that's the time that you decide to change. And you say, you know what? For one day, my religion's for sale. For one day, I will change my religion. I will not talk about religion. I will not hold Christian principles, values, and ideas because of the setting which I find myself. Or any time there's a religious discussion. I wonder if Christians fall into that trap. You know, we're surrounded by individuals. A religious discussion starts, but we decide, you know what? Maybe I'm not going to speak up. Maybe I'm not going to say anything. You know, for this day, for this hour, for this minute, I'm going to sell my religion just to the people that are around me. You know, the problem with selling out when it comes to your religion, the problem of giving up your religion in certain situations, is that your light doesn't shine, does it? Matthew chapter 5, it talks about us being the light of the world, the salt of the earth. If you're in this constant state where you're switching masters, if you're in this constant state where it depends on the people that are in the room what your beliefs are, no one's going to see the light. No one's going to be led to Christ. Because you know what people around you, what they see? They don't see Christ. They see the world or whatever facade you're trying to put up. You know, today I'm trying to be the work time. Tomorrow I'm trying to be the preacher time. Are you switching in and out? Are you trying to serve different masters? Because if you live your life that way, you'll never be a light to the world and those that are around you. Certainly Peter had some problems, and I'm not saying that certainly Peter wasn't perfect. Sometimes, like I said, we fall into this trap. We either put a guy way up here or we tear him down way down here. But the reality is we're all humans and we all make mistakes. We're not perfect individuals, but certainly I think we can acknowledge that Peter made a mistake here. Think about our idolatry or covetousness for a second. Do people sell their religion for that? Now, see, that's something that maybe we can understand, because that a lot of times can be tied to money. That can be tied to money. Let's turn to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, we have the parable of the rich fool. The parable of the rich fool, starting in verse 15. And he said to them, Jesus speaking, it says, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of things he possesses." Then he spoke a parable to them. The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, "What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?" So he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasures for himself and is not rich towards God.'" You know, sometimes people do make this exchange of physical worldly things for their soul. And I think that's the picture that we're getting right here of the parable of the rich fool. He's focused on worldly things, and right before the parable starts, we see the discussion is in relation to covetousness, which is having a desire for something so much that you would compromise your religion, your beliefs. You would move those things, you would compromise your morality to get whatever you want to get. And we see that this rich fool, he is in pursuit of worldly things. And there's nothing wrong with some worldly things, so on and so forth, but what happens is when it substitutes God. And that's the same thing as idolatry. And covetousness and idolatry are very closely linked. Because you got your idol there, covetousness means that I'll compromise anything to make sure that I get that idol. People have trouble seeing this in their own lives. Perhaps this individual had trouble seeing it in his own life. But think how much time we put into pursuing worldly things. And I understand that we have to make a living, and the Bible teaches it that those things, that we have to make a living, provide for our family. Such things are Christian ideas, and I wouldn't refute any of those. But isn't there a line somewhere? Now, I'm not saying I have that line here this evening, but where does the line be drawn when it comes to idolatry and covetousness? When have we went too far in the pursuit of worldly things that God has been moved to the back burner? And I really think that is the answer, is that when God moves to the back burner, that is when we moved into idolatry. That's when our covetousness has taken over our heart, when God moves into second place. In any form, if God moves into second place. In James chapter 4 and verse 4 says, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. How friendly are you with the world? How much time do you spend with the world? And I understand that we live in this world. I understand that we have to evangelize. I understand that we have to live our life. I understand that there's going to be worldliness all around us. But how friendly are you with the world? Have you thought of how much time you spend in the world and not on spiritual things? You know, I oftentimes think of Bible reading and Bible studying, for example. You know, it's hard to, you know, because the Bible never lays out Christian must study X amount a day. But I will say one Christian idea that I think we can find throughout the Bible is that Christians should be studying their Bible daily. Now, it doesn't necessarily say how many hours, but I do think about that many times. Particularly when I read historical writings, it's amazing. If the Bible wasn't naturally printed before the printing press, how was the Bible spread? There was only a few manuscripts around. People would go to the places where those manuscripts were, and they would sit down until they had memorized pages and pages of the Bible. And then they would go, and they would spread it. They would take hours and hours trying to write it. Of course, after the printing press. You know, when you read some of these stories of these people of the past, Christians of the past, and how much time they dedicated to study, sometimes personally when I read those things, it puts me to shame. Now, I'm not saying that a Christian's life can be consumed every minute of the day with Bible study. That's not what I'm saying. But it does make you think, doesn't it? You know, I always, you know, try to look at myself. You've got to be careful with the comparing game. But you do look at America and you do think, you know what, did my grandparents study the Bible more than I did? Did my great-grandparents study the Bible more than I did? When you look at the founding fathers, even, we don't even have to go that far back in history. They were quoting the Bible in their political speeches to one another as they were discussing things. Not even that far back, you think of the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln and how many Bible references he had throughout his writings and throughout his speeches. It's not that long ago. I'm not saying that we're going to be perfect. But certainly there's that idea that we can always be better. But the world is creeping in around us, and the world is saying, I'll take your time. And we have to stand firm and say, I won't sell my religion, I won't sell Christianity, I will stand here. And sometimes you got to say no to the world. That's what it amounts to. A lot of times, people's first no is to what? It's the Bible study. You know, I got Johnny's sporting event tonight. I've got this over here that I've got to do. I've got this over here. I'm moving. I'm building a house. I got all these things. All these things pop into our lives all the time. It's So it's his birthday. You have all these things. I'm not saying those things aren't there, and I'm not saying that these things around us are necessarily sinful in nature.
But we say no to Bible study before we say no to other things.
And you got to think, to some degree, is that some form of idolatry? That somehow we elevate these things before we elevate Bible study and spiritual things. It's so easy to get lost. You know, you look at the rich fool, and you look at some of these things that he's doing, building barns, I've done that, you know. Gathering food, I've done that. Some of these things, but what happens is it consumes your life, and when it consumes your life, it consumes your time, and when it consumes your time, what slowly puts out is your religion and your relationship with Jesus Christ. Idolatry and covetousness is a dangerous thing, and many times it's hard to spot. You know, you think of also just sin and worldliness in general. I mean, you know, sin, that's a huge category, but you think of worldliness, you think of lust. How many people have exchanged their relationship with Christ for lustful relationships? In 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, it says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." You know, you think of King David. You know, once again, we fall into that same problem. David did a lot of wonderful things, but then again, he made mistakes just like everybody else. We think of David getting lost in his lust. We see David lost in this sexual excursion that he takes in his life, and the toll that it takes on his life and his family. Worldliness is all around us. And what Satan is trying to say is your religion for sale? You know, when lust comes into your life, is your religion for sale? When sin comes into your life, is your religion for sale? When idolatry comes into your life, is your religion for sale? All of these are basically, all of these things are surrounding us, and it's a one big question. Is your religion for sale? What's your price? And Satan throughout our lives is trying to find our price. What's the price for you? What's the price that you would give up for your soul? Will it take a little sin here? Will it take a little sin there? A little alcohol, a little drugs, what will it take? Is your religion for sale? It's so sad because when we take a step back, it's so easy to see. I don't want to make any of these exchanges. My religion is not for sale. My Christianity is not for sale. It doesn't matter what you would pay me a year. It doesn't matter what clothing you would clothe me in. It doesn't matter what kind of food you're getting. It doesn't matter all these sinful things and sinful temptations. My religion is not for sale. We take a step back, we can all see them. I think we can all understand the idea that we see in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. For we have brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we are carrying nothing out. And having food and clothing with these, we shall be content. It's so sad that people will sell their religion for something so small as 30 seconds of sin, 5 minutes of sin, a year of sin. It doesn't matter how much sin it is, how much would it be worth to you if you lose your soul? It's so easy to see people on the outside. It's so easy to look at other people and see their mistakes and acknowledge those people's mistakes. It's easy to look at that young Levite and it's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Why are you selling yourself into this religion? You know, we look at Peter. What are you doing in this situation? Why are you denying Jesus Christ? We look at the rich fool. What are you doing exchanging these worldly things for the eternal things? What are you doing, David? Why are you getting caught up in the lust? Certainly the challenges are all around us. We can look at those exchanges and from the outside we're like, why would people do such things? Why would we do such things? Why would we sell our religion? You know, you think of Jacob and Esau, we look at that old Testament example. You know, you got Jacob. We got Esau coming in, and he's exhausted, and what exchange do we have there? The exchange of soup for a birthright. And we look at that, and it's like, what are you doing with your birthright? You can have all the soup you want, you know. You can eat, and we just see that and say, that is a poor exchange. That is an exchange that's not considering the long term. And isn't that what happens to us? Isn't that what happens to individuals? Is for the moment, they forget about the greatest exchange of their life. The greatest exchange of their life. In Matthew chapter 16 and verse 26, actually I'm in the wrong place here. But in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 26, it says, "For what does it profit if a man gains the whole world and loses his own soul, or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" It's the exchange of your life. And what Satan's trying to do is trying to convince you to make the exchange. It doesn't matter what exchange, it doesn't matter if the exchange is lust, it doesn't matter if it's sin, it doesn't matter if it's worldliness, it doesn't matter if it's money. He's just trying to figure out, what can he get on you? Can he get people on you? Can he get money on you? Can he get something on you to make the exchange for your soul? I don't think any of us in our right mind would sit down at a table with Satan, sit down at the table with Satan and say, "Hey, let's make an exchange. Your soul for whatever sin on the other side." You know, and we look at these, you know, we look at Jacob and Esau, and that's kind of the exchange that we see happening. A birthright for a bowl of soup doesn't make sense. We sit down with Satan at the table, lustful moment, eternity. Let's make that exchange. Of course, no one thinks that way in the moment when they're making these exchanges, when they're selling out their religion, when they're selling out their Christianity. But I think we have to, as Christians, be very slow to inspect ourselves and to make sure that we are not selling or exchanging anything for our souls. You know, I think about our brothers and sisters in Christ. I think many times it's hard for us to see the weaknesses in our own lives for whatever reason. We're just not being honest with ourselves. We're lost in the cloud of sin, all these things. But I think one thing that we need to consider, are we watching out for when our brothers and sisters are watching out for us? Many times our brothers and sisters in Christ see our problems long before they manifest into a bigger problem where we're making an exchange for our soul, for our eternity. Many times our brothers and sisters are watching out for us, and they see situations that we get into, and they are cautious, and many times you know, one day it's going to be my daughter. One day it's going to be my daughter, and I don't know what I'm going to do. So we look at these things and these exchanges, but when we consider our brothers and sisters in Christ, there's no people really on this earth that are more concerned than how many times do we shut those people out. Those people that are around us and closest to us, those are the people we cut out first. Mom and Dad, you know what, I'm not going to listen to them. You know, brothers and sisters in Christ that have known us for a long period of time, have saw us grow in the faith, have seen much of our Christian life, a lot of the times they're the first people we block out. You think of our elders, our overseers. In 1 Peter chapter 5, it talks about the elders and some of their responsibilities. But you think about the elders, are sometimes those are the first people that we shut out of our lives. You know, what's sad is in our society, warning others has become politically incorrect. I think it is, slowly but surely. Politically incorrect to warn those that are around us to say, "Hey, you might be making a mistake here." And certainly, what is extremely politically incorrect in our society today is to say that there is a consequence for selling or exchanging out your religion or your belief. People don't acknowledge that anymore, do they? You can sell out your religion, there's no consequence. There's no eternal consequence, there's no hell, there's no big deal to that. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 20-22, certainly there's this idea that we can give up, we can sell, we can exchange our soul. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 20-22 says, "For if, after we escape the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again estranged in them and overcome, and the latter end is worse for them than the beginning. For it would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness, than having known it, to turn from the holy commandment delivered to them. But it has happened to them, according to the true proverb, the dog returns to his own vomit, and a sow having washed to wallowing in the mire." We have to think about our faith. And what's sad in our society is the consequences of giving up your religion and giving up your beliefs has almost been lost. You know, you look at some of these tragedies that have happened around our country in relation to shooting. I think to some degree we have to stop and contemplate that it's because people don't think there's going to be consequences for their actions. Because what does the atheist say? "Well, you know, after this world there's nothing." And as once people are convinced that the worst thing that can happen to them is death, and they're okay with that, they'll go and do all kinds of atrocities. But you know what? if people realized that there was a consequence, that there was a fate far worse than death, maybe we wouldn't see so much of these atrocities that we see across our country. But you know what we have preached in the schools and spread throughout our media? There's no consequence for your beliefs. There's no consequence for selling your beliefs. In fact, there's no consequences at all. And because there's no consequences at all, people come to all kinds of crazy conclusions. Certainly, there's an application for our lives. The application is, can you see the exchanges that you're making? Can you see the exchanges that other people are making around you for their souls? In Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 21, it says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Can you see the exchange that's not worthwhile? Because many people cannot see the exchange that they're making. The exchange for sin, the exchange for worldliness, the exchange they're making for the approval of other people around them. Can you see the exchanges that people are making? Don't sell out Jesus Christ. In Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 23, the Bible gives us this idea of buy the truth and do not sell it. Buy the truth and do not sell it. You know, Jesus, when you're talking about cost, he purchased us with his own blood. We've been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb, Jesus Christ. It doesn't matter if we make the mistake. We could make horrible mistakes in our lives. We could sell out Jesus over and over again for years and years and years. And Jesus says, I'll redeem you and I'll take you down. But certainly us as Christians have to be cautioned that once Jesus has bought us back, it's not impossible to run away again. It's not impossible to say, you know what? I know Jesus bought me back, but I want to go back into the world. And you know what? If you go back in the world, Jesus will buy you back again. But it certainly puts you in a dangerous condition, doesn't it? Perhaps you need to get in a right relationship with God. Perhaps you need to become a New Testament Christian. Perhaps you need the prayers of the church. We wouldn't want anything more than that. If you're subject to Lord's invitation anyway, yes, please come as you stand as you sing.